Hebrews chapter 9. We are going to be doing most of that chapter here this morning. And the title of this morning's class is How Christ Purifies Us. We're going to be looking at how Jesus saved us. What happened to make that happen? So let's begin with a prayer and then we will get started. Is this book written to a group of Jews who are going through challenges? Things started out okay, but now they're being persecuted and they're discouraged. And so as we go through this book, the Hebrew writer explains to them things about Jesus to help them understand who Jesus is and to motivate them because of that. Well, in this morning's class, I want to look at this question right here. Why did Jesus have to die? That's what we're going to focus on this morning. Looking at chapter 9, to me, this chapter really explains this question, explains the answers here. Now, if we ask this question right now, I think we'd all have answers to it. It wouldn't seem like that complicated of a question. We could rattle off a whole bunch of different things that we've heard our whole lives. We could talk about how Christ died to forgive us of our sins. He died so that we wouldn't have to die. He died so that we could go to heaven. All these different things that we've heard over and over again. But the thing that I really like about this chapter is that the Hebrew writer, he doesn't just give some small little trite answer here. He goes through and he gives us some pictures. He's going to give us three different illustrations so that we can picture in our minds what Jesus did. He wants us to visualize, here's what it looks like for Jesus to bring us salvation. And I know for me, reading that and seeing that imagery just enriches that so much more. It helps me appreciate so much more Christ's death for me. And so I hope that that's what it does for all of us this morning, is that we will gain a much deeper appreciation for our salvation by studying Hebrews chapter 9. Now let's look at our map and set the scene for where we are. We've been in this section for quite a while now of Jesus as our high priest. In chapter 4, at the end of that chapter, we started out that section, how he said to us, Jesus is our high priest, and here's what that means. And he was about to launch into that, but then he broke off and got talking about some other things. But he came back in chapter 7 to talk about Jesus as our high priest. And for the Jews, that would have been an image that they would have been very familiar with. They were very familiar with high priests would go in once a year, they would offer blood, and that would atone for the sins of the people. And so here the Hebrew writer is saying, that's exactly what Jesus did. He offered his own blood, he made that sacrifice to take away all of our sins. Just like that high priest that you're so familiar with, that's who Jesus is today. And he compares Jesus to this man, Melchizedek, way back in the Old Testament. And he shows from that Jesus' priesthood is eternal. Jesus is always there for us. He's always up in heaven, there helping us with our challenges. And he also shows how Jesus is not like the priests that they're used to under the old law. Instead, he's up this whole new priesthood that's changed everything about everything for them. And so they need to understand this whole new system. Then, today, or last week, what we talked about was this new covenant that brings in. Because Jesus is this high priest today, and he's changed the whole system around, now we're under this new covenant. And this new covenant, it's made the old one obsolete. The old law, the Old Testament there, it's now all obsolete because of what we have that's so much better. And he talks about what it really means to live under this new covenant. He quotes a prophecy from Jeremiah that shows how wonderful that is. Now, that brings us to today's class. In today's class, here's what he's going to do. He's going to give us a couple different scenes. The first scene is going to be the Day of Atonement, where the high priest would go into the temple back in the Old Testament, and he would offer blood, and that would take away the sins of the people. And he's going to say, that's exactly what Jesus did for us today. So he's going to walk us through that whole scene, first of all. Then, towards the end of our section today, we're going to hit this, where he talks about how Jesus' death is what inaugurated the new covenant that we're under today. He's going to talk about how in the Old Testament, blood symbolized the inauguration of a covenant. And the same way with us today, as Jesus died on that cross, it symbolizes this whole new relationship that we have with God because of that blood. So that's the part, that's where we are in the book as a whole. We're getting towards the end. Next week's going to be the end of this priesthood section. So we're getting towards the end. And in this, he's really wanting us to visualize and see, here's what it means for Jesus to be our high priest. Okay, so we talked about how this answers the question of why Jesus had to die. And he's going to do that through three different illustrations. The first illustration is the Day of Atonement. That's how this chapter begins, is by visualizing this Day of Atonement. And he's going to start by taking us back to the Old Testament and saying, here's what the Day of Atonement looked like for the Jews way, way back. Here's how it used to look. Now, here's what it looks like for us today. So let's start reading chapter 9, verse 1, the book of Hebrews. Now, even the first covenant had regulations for worship and an earthly place of holiness. For a tent was prepared, the first section, in which were the lampstand and the table and the bread of the presence. It is called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, and which was a golden urn holding the manna, and Aaron's staff that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. So the writer begins this. It's kind of like watching a movie here. He wants to take us back in time to this scene. Now the Jews, they were very familiar with the idea of a Day of Atonement. They knew that every year the priest went into the temple and he offered blood and took away the sins of the people. They knew that. They had never been inside the temple because the regular people weren't allowed in the temple. Only the priests were allowed in there. And besides that, he's going to take us back in time to where, to the ideal. When the tabernacle was first built, here's what it really looked like in all of its beauty for the high priest to go in on this special day and take away the people's sins. So he's going to play this for us like a movie. He starts out by setting the scene. In this first paragraph, he goes through all these different details to say, this is what it looks like. Imagine that you're there on this day, and here's what you see around you. So here's our little illustration. We've got two sections to the tabernacle, the holy place and the most holy place. The small box there is the most holy place. The bigger one's the holy place. And so he wants us to picture this tabernacle. The walls are all made out of gold. They're wood and then covered in gold. They have beautiful designs all over them. There's two curtains. You have to go in through a curtain to get into the holy place. You can go through another curtain to go into the most holy place. The curtains are these beautifully woven designs with cherubim pictured on them, all sorts of different pictures on there. And when you go into that first room, first thing you're going to see is this golden lampstand. And this golden lampstand is what lights up the whole room. It's this oil lamp that's quite large, has all these different flames on it, and it's large enough to light up the whole room there. Now, you notice something when we read through that. Did you notice a detail that was mentioned about practically every piece item there in the tabernacle? What was it that we see over and over again mentioned?
Gold.
Everything's made out of gold. He wants us to picture this extreme, magnificent beauty. I mean, the walls are gold, the furniture's gold, everything's gold. It's gaudy, it's beautiful. And there's something attractive to that. When you think about this worship service that where everything's all beautiful, and the priests come in their long, beautiful robes, something attractive about that kind of worship. And he wants us to see that and see that picture of how magnificent this was. Now, in the next paragraph, he's going to do something with that. But for now, he just wants us to see, enjoy that beauty. So we've got this golden lampstand. Then we've got this golden table. And on the table, there was the showbread. There was 12 loaves of bread there. every day on that table, 12 very large loaves of bread. Then the next piece of furniture is the altar of incense. Now this altar, he refers to as being in the most holy place. But when you go back to the Old Testament and read about it, it actually was put in the holy place. Now that brings up a question, why does he change the location on that? And it seems like when you go through and you read the Old Testament, that although it was in the holy place, its function had a lot more to do with the most holy place. The idea was, as every day they would go and they would burn incense on this altar, and the smoke from that altar would go through the curtain all the way into the most holy place, into God's presence. So he lists it here more with what the function has to do with rather than the actual location of the item. And there are some Old Testament scriptures that do make that connection between the altar of incense and the most holy place as far as its function. So that's the next thing we see. Those are the three items we see in this first room. Then we go into the second room. And this is the most holy place. Again, all the walls are covered in gold. And here is the Ark of the Covenant. Again, all made out of gold. It's this golden box, and on top of it are cherubim, which are also made out of gold, the statues of cherubim. Now, does anyone know what this ark symbolized? What was the point of this Ark of the Covenant? What, any symbolism of it in the Old Testament? Well, one thing, you read about a few different things, but one thing you see in the Psalms is it's referred to as God's footstool. That's where God, it's almost like God's throne, but it's not even his full throne. It's just a footstool under his throne. So the idea is God sitting somewhere, perhaps in heaven, and his feet are reaching all the way down onto this item, some kind of imagery like that. In contrast to the pagan temples actually would have had a statue of their deity. Here, God had them build it in such a way that there's no statue of God. Instead, there's this thing that represents that God is here. You can't see him, but this is just his footstool. He's so large that that's just where his feet are. Okay, so that sets the scene. Now, he also goes into a little bit of detail about what's in this ark. He talks about how there's a golden bowl of manna, there's Aaron's rod that budded, and there's the covenant, the Ten Commandments there, the covenant there put in the ark. Now, all of those would have had a lot of symbolism and meaning for the Jews. But now that he's set the scene, he says, okay, now a priest can go in. Let's read this, actually. Let's start in verse 6 and read about the priests. Verse 6, these preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties. But into the second section, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. Okay, so he says the priests go in every day to this section, and they do their things. They make sure the lamps are burning. They offer their incense. They do all this stuff. But the most holy place, only the high priest can go into, and only once a year. And he goes in, and he takes some blood, and he offers it before God there on the Day of Atonement. It's that one day a year. He offers that blood before God, and the people's sins are forgiven. Now, he's played this video for us to see how magnificent it was. What a great day. Can you imagine where the whole nation of Israel is waiting expectantly as this high priest goes in and he takes blood, and there's all sorts of ceremonies to go along with it, and then he offers that blood before God, and the sins are forgiven, and there's all this joy and happiness that we have that relationship with God. And it's beautiful. But then, in this last verse we read, he starts showing us some problems. And the problems are, first of all, only the high priest can go in to this most holy place. He's the only one who can go in. The rest of Israel, they can't actually go into God's presence. And he only can go in once a year. He's the most, if you want to say, the most holy guy in the nation, or however you want to say that, but he can only go in once a year. And not only that, when he goes in, he has to take blood and he has to offer sacrifice. It's not, even though they have this relationship with God, they can't just walk into God's presence. There's this separation. This is basically what he's showing here. although they have this relationship with God, they can't actually get in there to God. There's a separation. They have to keep out. That's a problem. As wonderful and beautiful as this is, there's a problem there. And he says in verse 8, "By this the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy place is not yet opened, as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation." So here's the problem. The holy place is closed off. Nobody can get into this most holy place. He says it didn't perfect the conscience. He's critiquing the old law. He's saying, even though he offered this blood, it didn't really do what you would want this sacrifice to do. It didn't perfect the conscience. Our conscience is what tells us whether we're doing right or wrong. And you don't really feel forgiven when you're separated away from God. There was something lacking here with this system. And then he points out another problem with it. He says it's just a bunch of regulations for the body, like food and drink and washings. Now, when you go back through the Old Testament, you really see that. When you go through, you see this, you read the laws. There are all these laws about you. If you touch a dead body, you need to go wash yourself. If you're eating a meal, you need to make sure you don't eat pigs. You need to make sure you don't eat this meat over here. You can only eat this special kind of meat over here. When all these different rules about all these different things that sound like health regulations. And when you read through the Old Testament, it's kind of confusing. You think, why does God want to give all these rules that sound like how to be healthy? I don't need the Bible to tell me how to be healthy. What is this about? And the author draws attention to that fact. Here's the old law. When it really came down to it, in a physical sense, it was just about how to take care of your physical body. Well, that's not very useful. We need forgiveness. We need a relationship with God. And then he makes this point. He says here in verse 9, which is symbolic for the present age. Now, that word symbolic, your translations may have something different. The translation that I really like is the translations that say parable. It was a parable for the present age. This whole old law, it was very, very physical. But yet, the point of it was a parable for what we have today. Okay, what's a parable? Anyone have an idea of that? What does the word parable mean?
A story that illustrates a point.
A story that illustrates a point. Jesus told lots of parables. And with Jesus' parables, he would give you a physical picture. This symbolizes something else. So here's this sower. He's sowing some seed. He's planting all these crops. That symbolizes something spiritual. The author is saying that's what the old law was. It was very physical. It had all these rules about washing yourself. It had all this gold and robes and special things. But it was just physical to be a picture of something that is spiritual. It was to be a picture of what we have today in Jesus. Now, because of that, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for me to go back and try to live out those physical things. It was just a parable. If I'm listening to Jesus' parables and Jesus tells about the story of a man sowing some seed, planting some crops, I shouldn't read that and say, okay, now I know how to be a good gardener. I missed the point. The point is the spiritual. I look at this physical picture so that I can understand what's really happening with heaven and what's happening spiritually with Jesus' sacrifice. And so now he's going to take us on what the real meaning is here. Okay, let's read verse 11. "But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent that not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? So now he takes us to the second section of this scene, the new day of atonement, what Christ did for us. And here he's saying, this is what happened. When Jesus died on the cross, here's spiritually what happened. The scene is heaven. Jesus went into heaven. He offered his own blood before the presence of God, and that took away our sins. He describes it as entering a tent that's not made with hands. Here's in the Old Testament, it was this tabernacle, this tent that was made by humans. He's saying here, Jesus entered something so much greater than any tent here on earth. He entered heaven itself, created by God. He went there and he did it just one time. He didn't have to go every year like the high priest did and offer his blood. He did it just one time, and he did it for everybody. It wasn't some exclusive thing that just saves the Jews or something. He's saying this is a forgiveness that's for everyone, everyone who's willing to follow God. And then he offered his own blood. It wasn't just blood of animals like they did in the Old Testament. It was Jesus' own blood that he offered to save everybody. Now, as beautiful as all that gold was and all that stuff was that we just saw, he's saying, this is so much more real and this is so much more magnificent. This is what it's all about. If we can see this, we can visualize why Jesus had to die. And here's what it really means. Here's what Jesus' blood means. He says it secured eternal redemption for us. Because he offered just one sacrifice, it was enough to save us for eternity, that we can be with God in heaven forever. It purified our consciences. It did what the old law could not do. And that now we really understand that we are forgiven. When we are saved, we know that God has taken away that sin and that we can finally be with God. And so now, here's his final application from all of that. So now that we understand this beautiful picture and we see what Jesus did for us, here's what we can get from that. So we should serve God. That's how he ends it. He says, at the end of verse 14, he purified our consciences from dead works to serve the living God. Jesus saved us, so now we truly can serve God. So that's the first illustration. Now we get that all in our minds. That's a picture of what Jesus did when he died on the cross. That's why he had to die. Now, let's look at illustration number two. Second illustration is about a family inheritance. The first one was from the old law. This one is more from what to them would have been modern day, and for us, really applies to our modern day as well. We understand this idea of an inheritance. So let's start reading in verse 15. Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeemed them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. For where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Okay, here's what he's going to show to us. He's going to use the imagery of a family inheritance. You know how when a family member dies, the children typically inherit that person's possessions. Now, he uses the word a will, and this works really well in the original Greek, apparently. He uses the word will. We understand what a will is. The father or parents write this will, and then that will dictates who gets what of the family inheritance. Now, the word will works really well in Greek because in Greek, the word will and the word covenant were the exact same word. It could have different definitions depending on what you're talking about, but it sounded the same. So he can do kind of a play on words here. He uses will and covenant interchangeably. He's trying to explain to us what the new covenant is like, but he's talking about a will to illustrate that. And he's using the same word because it's the same word in Greek. So it works really well for him in this original writing. But let's visualize this will. So here's a dad. Here are the children. The dad has all this stuff. Now, what is it that's going to take for the children to get that stuff? Well, what's going to happen is the dad dies, and then the will goes into effect, and the children inherit all of the stuff. They receive that family inheritance. And that's a picture we're all familiar with. We know how that works. We see that in work that way in modern times today. Now, here's how he compares that to Jesus. Here's Jesus. Here's us. Jesus has all of this promised inheritance for us. As he calls it the eternal inheritance. Now, what's going to happen? What's going to need to happen for us to inherit those blessings? Jesus is going to have to die. So here, Jesus dies on the cross, and then the will goes into effect. And the will, he uses the words interchangeably, which means the new covenant. The will meaning the new covenant, the covenant that Jesus set up with his blood, goes into effect. We inherit all of the wonderful blessings. We receive that eternal inheritance, as he describes here. It's a picture of the reason Jesus had to die was so that he could set in motion this new covenant. This new covenant could only go into motion when Jesus died. And then we can receive that inheritance. We can receive that forgiveness. We can receive heaven. So that's another picture of understanding why Jesus had to die. Now, on to the third picture. This one is the inauguration day, as I call it. The day when the first covenant was inaugurated, the covenant of in the Old Testament, that old law, had the special inauguration day where that covenant was set in motion. So he's going to start by showing us the inauguration of the new covenant in comparison to the old covenant. He's going to take us back in time to really to the old covenant and use that to illustrate the inauguration of the new covenant. Now let's read that before we get started here. Verse 17. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of the calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." Okay, so what he's saying here is he says covenants are always made with blood. Now, we don't understand that really in our culture because we don't make covenants with blood. But they understood that because they made covenants with blood. In the ancient world, covenants were typically made with blood. And you can see that as you read through the Old Testament. When a covenant was formed between two individuals, there's typically some kind of a sacrifice made. You see that way back with the story of Abraham. You remember that strange story where Abraham, where God makes a promise to Abraham. He makes this covenant with Abraham. And he has Abraham take some animals. And he cuts those animals in half, Abraham does. And he lays those two halves down on the ground. And then God passes between the two halves. And that is God making a covenant with Abraham. Now, it seems like God was probably using a system that Abraham was already very familiar with. That was how they did this in the ancient world, how they made covenants. They would kill an animal, put these two halves, walk between the halves, and this sealed the covenant. We see the same thing with Moses when there's a covenant, when this new covenant, this covenant between the nation of Israel and God is set up. With that covenant, Moses takes blood. He kills some animals. He takes the blood. And he sprinkles the blood on the people. And that sets up this new covenant. To us, that seems absolutely disgusting. But there was great symbolism to that. with this. And here's the symbolism of killing an animal. It symbolized that if I break that covenant, I'm going to die the way that animal died. It's a really gross way to picture this. But here's how one way we can see this. We're just to kind of prove this, if you look at the book of Jeremiah, chapter 34, verse 18 says, "And the men who transgressed my covenant and did not keep the terms of the covenant that they made before me, I will make them like the calf that they cut in two and pass between its parts." So God is saying, you broke my covenant, you're going to be like that calf that got killed and got cut in half. And God was just telling them what was understood in the ancient world. You make a solemn promise. I am going to do this for you. You're going to do this for me. It's a solemn promise that you do not break. If you break it, the penalty is you're going to be dead like this animal's dead. That's the idea. Now, what that means for us today. Jesus set up a new covenant with his blood. Remember there at the Last Supper where Jesus said, "This is the blood of the covenant," as he gives them that wine there. And he says, "This is the blood of the new covenant." Here's what he means. He's saying, I'm setting up a new covenant with you. Just like all those covenants that you read about, you're familiar with. I'm setting up a new covenant with you, but there's a difference with this one. This one, I'm not killing some animal. I'm killing myself. This is my blood to set up this new covenant. What does that mean? Here's what it means. Jesus is saying, I already paid the penalty for this covenant. The idea was, you kill an animal, that animal, if I break the covenant, I die like the animal died. Here, Jesus is symbolizing, I already died for you. I already paid the price for breaking the covenant. This covenant that Jesus set up with us is so different from any of those covenants in the past. The old covenants were set up with, here's a covenant. You don't dare break this or you will die. The new covenant is set up with, this is a covenant of me forgiving you. This is a covenant that because of what I have done, I have already paid the penalty. Now you can have forgiveness. You can have that relationship with God. You see how beautiful this new covenant is? That's what Jesus has given us. Now, let's look at the picture that the Hebrew writer is painting for us. He's taking us back to Exodus 24 when he says here, he says in verse 19, "For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of the calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, 'This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you.'" That is a quotation from Exodus 24. Let's turn back and look at that. One thing that I've really seen with studying through Hebrews is when the Hebrew writer quotes something from the Old Testament, if we follow that cross-reference, there's typically a pot of gold there at the end of that rainbow. There's something there to discover, and I really believe that's the case with this quotation. Exodus 24. In this chapter, God has given them all of these laws, and he's setting up here this new covenant, or this covenant with them. I keep saying new covenant, but that gets us confused with the new covenant that we have. He's setting up the old covenant here. And the chapter begins in verse 1, Exodus 24, verse 1. "Then he said to Moses, 'Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him.'" This sounds like typical Old Testament here. Moses and a few chosen people get to come up onto Mount Sinai to the presence of God. But there's some restrictions. Moses gets to go into the presence of God. Here's Moses, he's with God. But the elders and all the other people, they worship God at a distance. There's this separation. Don't get too close to God. You got to stand back. We're sinful people. We can't get too near God. There's a separation here. Okay, so that sets the scene for the chapter. Then, let's read about the covenant. Verse 3, then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. All right, so they're agreeing to the covenant. We are going to keep this covenant. Now, let's drop down to verse 6. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. Okay, Moses comes to, can't get near God. Moses comes to the people. He takes blood. He sprinkles it all over the people. To us, that's absolutely disgusting. But it symbolized this blood is putting you into a relationship with God. You have now have a covenant relationship with God because of this blood. Then, let's see what happens after he does that. In verse 9, then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. So here Moses and 70 guys go up on the mountain, and they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. This is a very unique thing in the Old Testament. The people go up, and they go into God's presence, and they see God face to face. Here's what happens after the covenant is sealed. Before that covenant, there was this distance. Now he has this very special moment after that covenant, when they come right into the presence of God and they see God. And he says God didn't stretch out his hand against them. He didn't hurt them. There was peace between God and these people. And then they eat and drink. Perhaps some sort of symbolic meal sealing this covenant. They eat there in God's presence, right there with God. That is a very unique occasion for the Old Testament. You don't see things like this. It's showing the power of the covenant. You make this covenant with God, and now you can finally have a relationship with him. Now, it's obvious what that means for us. You think about Jesus. He comes down from the presence of God. He takes his own blood. He sprinkles it on us through his death. Then finally, we can go and be with God and have that relationship with God because of that wonderful covenant. That's the imagery in Exodus 24. That's the picture that it gives us of our relationship with God. It is rich. Okay, now the second part of this. He inaugurated the covenant with blood, but then the other thing the Hebrew writer wants us to see is that that blood purified everything. Let's read that back in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 21. And in the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Here's what he's trying to show. He's trying to show us that blood in the Old Testament was what brought about forgiveness. Everything was purified by blood. And here he says how Moses sprinkled this thing and that thing and the other thing. He goes through all these things that Moses sprinkled with blood. Now here's a verse that kind of shows this. This may be what he's referring back to. This is where Moses is setting up this covenant. And he killed it, and Moses killed the animal. He killed the animal, and Moses took the blood and with his finger put it on the horns of the altar around it and purified the altar and poured out the blood at the base of the altar and consecrated it to make atonement for it. He's got to make this altar holy, so he throws blood on the altar. And that purifies it and it consecrates it, and it atones for it with this blood. And so the Hebrew writer is saying, you see that a lot in the Old Testament. You see blood being used to purify things. Now, to us, that doesn't make any sense. Blood, it's gross. You don't make things clean by throwing blood on them. But God wanted to give us that imagery. So over and over again throughout the Old Testament, he showed us this picture. Blood is what purifies things and makes them holy. The Hebrew writer is giving us a picture of the story of the Bible. The Hebrew writer's summarizing the Bible for us here. The summary is basically this. Throughout the Bible, there is sacrifice after sacrifice, blood after blood after blood, leading us to the cross. You could say there is a trail of blood leading throughout the Bible to the cross. Sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice. Blood after blood after blood. Gory stories, all sorts of things, describing that if you want to be forgiven, there's going to have to be some blood involved. Something's going to have to die to bring about that forgiveness. A passage that I really like that summarizes this is in Leviticus, when God is telling them, you're not allowed to eat blood. God explains the reason why. He says, because the life is in the blood. Doesn't that just summarize so much of the Bible? The life is in the blood. If you want to have eternal life, it has to be through blood. And that's why Jesus comes and he offers his blood to forgive us of our sins. That's why he had to do that. That's why he had to die. Now, there's lots of different kinds of deaths that God could have chosen for Jesus to die. But Jesus died that horrible, grotesque, bloody death on the cross that was a death that is just characterized and pictured by blood everywhere, with the idea of being blood is what brings about forgiveness. So that when we think of Jesus on the cross, we see that blood and we think, that is what brings our salvation. That's why he had to die on the cross. Those are the three pictures that he gave us. The Day of Atonement, the will, and then finally inaugurating a new covenant through blood. When we see those pictures, we can think about what Jesus did. And so, reading this chapter, we can see that's why Jesus had to die. The Hebrew writer doesn't give us just a few little sentences. He gives us some pictures to understand, to broaden our perspective of that's why Jesus had to die. And hopefully, by putting those images in our mind, it's much more meaningful for us. We understand the significance of that death, and we appreciate it so much more. That's the beginning of Hebrews 9. Go ahead. Yes, Tim.
I was going to say, those mind-boggling pictures that you just described, how wonderful truth that is. And it just makes me just want to say, thank you, God. That's a comment that God needs to hear from us. Because that's just, the truths you just described, that's what it's about. It's good.
Absolutely. Yep. Any other thoughts or comments on this section? All right. Next week, we are going to be at what I think of as sort of the pinnacle of the book of Hebrews. He's been building up this argument this whole time with Jesus' high priesthood. He's going to bring that all to a grand finale conclusion next week of Jesus' priesthood, what that really means for us. And then, for the rest of the book, is kind of coming down the mountain. The rest of the book is going to be all the application. Now that we understand who Jesus is and what he did, here's all the application for it. So next week is that great finale pinnacle of here's what Jesus did, here's what it means. So let's finish reading. It's going to be the end of chapter 9 and then the beginning of chapter 10 is what we'll do next week. All right, thank you, everybody.